From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Steve Bannon is, by all accounts, consolidating power in the White House, accumulating titles. Trump's chief strategist, senior counselor, now a full seat on the National Security Council. He's said to have the commander-in-chief's ear like nobody else, with the possible exception of son-in-law Jared Kushner. To some Americans, he's deliciously disruptive. To others, he's seriously disturbing, a far-right Svengali. This hour on Point, the man in the middle of the White House whirlwind, Steve Bannon. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. What do you make of what we're seeing in Steve Bannon? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Before we drill down on Steve Bannon in the White House, I want to turn to NBC's Chuck Todd, host, of course, of Meet the Press, famously at the center of that tangle with Kellyanne Conway, counselor to President Trump, over alternative facts. They tangled over the size of the crowd at the inauguration, and not just about the crowd size, but about what facts are. Here it was.
You're saying it's a falsehood, and they're giving Sean Spicer, our press secretary, gave alternative facts to that. But the point remains.
Wait a minute. Alternative facts? Alternative facts, four of the five facts he uttered.
Hey, Chuck, one thing he got right was
Zeke Miller. Four of the five facts he uttered were just not true. Look, alternative facts are not facts. They're falsehoods.
That was Chuck Todd with Kellyanne Conway. Chuck Todd, moderator for NBC's Meet the Press, political director for NBC News, political analyst for NBC Nightly News, in the very thick of it, and joining us today from New York. Chuck Todd, welcome back to On Point. It's been a while. Thanks for being here.
It has been a while, Tom. Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you. Alternative facts. You first called that out in terms of factual communication coming out of the White House in the, what is it now, 11 days, 12 days? I lose track. What's the trend line, Chuck? Is the fact quotient rising, falling? Where is it?
Look, I think it's fallen. I mean, let's be honest here. I think right now they view I worry that already the White House has a bunker mentality to it. And in my experience, when you see bunker mentality, professionally, I've seen it three times as far as in what I've covered. And I go back to the first days of the Clinton administration. During the Clinton-Lewinsky show, you saw a bunker mentality where that you just couldn't even sometimes agree upon a set of facts. During the worst days of the Iraq war, before the surge, ditto with the Bush White House. And I would say during the health care fight, particularly the last 2 months before they passed it, there were times that the Obama White House was in such a bunker mentality mode that you couldn't agree upon the basic premise of what's a fact and what isn't. So this happens when a White House gets into a bunker mentality. I think what's concerning to me is that I feel like they went into the White House with a bunker mentality. They began their presidency that way. And it's tough to dig out. You know, once you start in a bunker, it's tough to get out of it.
Chuck, Donald Trump came into the White House with a campaign behind him in which he promised significant change. And he's done a lot already in just this 10-plus days. Do you see him acting in a way in the White House that's going to bring about the changes that the voters who rallied behind him wanted?
I think it's possible, but it depends on how he goes about this, Tom. You know, I've been thinking about this. And in the way Donald Trump negotiates, and he made this clear in The Art of the Deal, okay? He's made this clear, which is he will sometimes go to an outrageous position, what appears to hold an outrageous position, to bring everybody along closer to that outrageous position. Oh, my God, you're trying to ban Muslims? No, I'm not trying to ban Muslims, but we really need to fix our vetting process. Now, he doesn't ever want to show that he's compromising. But if you suddenly, there is a method to this, discovering madness if he ends up getting, you know, a whole bunch of people in Congress saying, you know what, we do need better vetting process and let's write a vetting. So it depends on how he goes about this, right? Does he use his sort of flair for the dramatic and flair for the outrageous as a way to start negotiating, and then where he ends up is in a very rational place, you know, maybe more conservative than what some on the left want, or it may be more moderate than some of the right want. Is that how he uses this? Or is everything a fight and a battle, and is it his way or the highway? So, look, he ran as a disruptor. I think disruptors at their best go about trying to get their way the way I just described, you know, sort of be a, have a faint, you know, go too far. And that's a faint, not a, you know, it's all an attempt to sort of, you know, recalibrate the negotiation. If that's how he goes about this, he has an opportunity to be successful. If it is digging in your heels, then this is not going to be a success.
There's a lot riding on that as Americans watch. And, of course, along the way, you don't know if it'll be pushed too far, if it's a negotiating strategy that ends up somewhere reasonable. What are you watching for to say, wait a minute, this is out of bounds, off the rails, or this is within American democratic tradition and we're all right?
You know, I guess we're waiting to see, do the guardrails of our democracy work, right? And in this case, the guardrails, let's look at this executive order. It doesn't matter your position on it. There's universal agreement outside the West Wing that it was done in haste, that it was sloppy, and that it, you know, that it sort of, and then certainly the rollout of it, like forget the physical document, the rollout of it was also a mess. And sloppy. Do they acknowledge at least that? Do they show that they are willing to admit that error, even if they're not willing to admit what policy might work or not? That to me would show, okay, that's the sign of growth of of the management team.
Yep.
But right now, I have to say, I fear that there isn't a cohesive management team, that we still have a whole bunch of people that are in turf battles. And that is not healthy when you're in a political crisis, which they're in all already.
We're going to talk about Steve Bannon in this hour. He's right at the heart of the White House team, chief strategist, and we're told he was sort of the co-author of Donald Trump's inaugural address, drafting it anyway. Same with executive orders, one after another, those planned during the transition period and now, you know, coming out one after another, right in the heart of things. Very critical of the press, saying he sees the press as the opposition party. What about the role he plays and the philosophy, the impulse that you see him bringing to the Trump White House, Chuck Todd?
Well, look, he's the chief disruptor, right? You know, Donald Trump's a vehicle. I would say Steve Bannon the keeper of the Trump ideology. There are people that are close to Trump. There are even family members that are close to President Trump who say, you know what, he's not really an ideologue. He's not this, he's not that. That's not what Steve Bannon would tell people. Steve Bannon, I think, believes he does work for a president who does have an ideology, that there is a bit of a nationalist ideology, that President Trump is buying into that. And I think, I don't know the answer to that. You know, the amount of time I've spent with President Trump, as candidate Trump, both publicly and privately, he strikes me as that he certainly has tendencies that say, hey, you know, a little more of a less interventionist streak, a little more of that America First. I think he buys into that.
A little more. I mean, it was the main message of his inauguration, right? America First is right there, bold headline.
But I don't know if Donald Trump's a person believes that is his guiding ideology, is what I'm saying. With Steve Bannon, it definitely is. And so I think that, look, I think sometimes White House aides get too much credit when things are going good and too much blame when things are going bad. You know, at the end of the day, it is the president that is entrusting these people and all this stuff. So, but there's definitely, Bannon is the guy that is making the philosophical arguments in that room. He's not making political arguments. And look, his philosophy, and he said it at Breitbart many times in interviews, and I actually think that we all need to sort of get to know him a little bit better so people know this is who's probably the most influential policy voice in the White House. And what it is his philosophy. And I think he very much is wants to slow down, if not halt, globalization, and in all forms, whether that's immigration, whether that's on the economic front, but that is what animates him. And I think that the question is, can his style, which is in your face, you know, don't worry about tradition, blow it up. Can Washington adapt to Bannon's style? Or can Bannon adapt to Washington style? I don't know if either can happen, but I'm waiting to watch.
Chuck, talk to us for just a minute. We've got you for a couple more minutes here about what it's like to be right in the hot center of this when it comes to the news media. A lot of angry talk right off the bat from the Trump White House about the press. And, you know, Kellyanne Conway saying heads should roll. Do you is the press intimidated?
I don't feel intimidated. I'm sorry the words that they're choosing. I think individually they would deny they're trying to intimidate the press. But I think there's no doubt they're trying to, the most aggressive working of the refs that, that I've experienced in a while. I guess the culmination of a 45-year campaign that you could argue has been happening on the political side of things for quite some time to try to over-dramatize infiltration of political bias in the news media and try to over-dramatize it and make it sort of as the problem with American politics. So, look, honestly, it isn't fun. I'm not here to be, I don't like to be part of the story. And I know that the White House simply is looking for a political punching bag. And I've said this before, I certainly don't want to be a political prop. But at the same time, if anybody thinks I have ever done anything in a biased way or a dishonest way, I always tell them, show me.
Chuck, is the American press.
I don't want to do it.
Yep.
I'm happy to explain. And I think, you know, we just have to deal with it. I don't want us to engage in political warfare with the White House. I think that's not a good response. I think the best response is just do your job. And look, my true north is this, Tom.
Yep.
Is it true and is it legal right now when it comes to covering the administration? Then let the political debate happen. But I think until we can agree upon a set of facts and agree, you know, and then focus on the legality of the actions, then you start to have your political debate.
True and legal. It's a great place to start. Chuck Todd of NBC's Meet the Press. Thank you so much for being with us, Chuck.
Thank you, Tom. Always a pleasure.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Thanks again to Chuck Todd, moderator of NBC's Meet the Press, for joining us just a little bit there. We're going to forge right on into this hour talking about Steve Bannon and what's going on in Washington, the president's top strategy guy in the innermost inner circle, and how he sees the world. You can join us. How do you read Steve Bannon? He's all over the headlines lately, fingerprints all over Trump policy. Is he disruptive in a good way, Steve Bannon? Is he disturbing in a dark way, Steve Bannon? And can you believe the former head of Breitbart News, favorite of white nationalists coast to coast, is now the president's, maybe his closest guide, certainly one of them. A couple of people who've really watched him closely with us right now. Joshua Green joins us from Washington, senior national correspondent for Bloomberg News. His big profile last year of Steve Bannon was titled, "This Man is the Most Dangerous Political Operative in America." You can get that through a link at our website, onpointradio.org. Josh Green in Washington, thanks a lot for being with us.
Good to be with you, Tom.
And Josh Dossie joins us from Washington, White House reporter for Politico. He co-wrote a story on Steve Bannon yesterday with the headline, "The Man Behind Trump? Still Steve Bannon? And you can find a link to that at our website as well. Josh Dossie, thanks very much for joining us.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Josh, let's go, Dossie, first to Steve Bannon's fingerprints on this first nearly dozen days of the Trump administration. How deep, how prominent, how central?
Sure. We reported out that he has written a number of the executive orders, if not all of the executive orders. He's kind of put together an action plan for the administration on when the orders will be signed and when they won't be. And he has been counseling the president almost every day. I mean, a number of occasions, you know, other aides have gone out to big Washington events or gone out to do public engagements, and Bannon stays in the White House and, you know, often huddles with the president, sometimes, you know, hours every day. And he's kind of created his own structure there where he's bringing in, you know, several others from Breitbart who he's close with to help run policy in the White House. And we also think he was very critical in the cabinet picks that are facing confirmation right now, and putting to the president, you know, folks who he believes shared his ideology, shared the ideology of those who supported the president. And he's someone who continually tells the president, you know, you can do what you said on the campaign trail. Here's how you're going to do it. Here's what's in the orders. And the president seems to, you know, really respond to that and has taken his advice seemingly almost all the way.
Josh Green at Bloomberg Business Week, we want to understand exactly where you're coming from. The headline on your profile was pretty provocative, most dangerous political operative in America. What did you mean by that exactly, Josh Green?
Well, at the time, you know, the piece really focused on Bannon's strategy for stopping Hillary Clinton. He was part of a group of conservatives who conceived the idea for the book Clinton Cash, which was so damaging to Clinton just as she was launching her presidential campaign, because it delineated a lot of the financial relationships that she and her foundation had with foreign governments and some less than reputable donors, and really drove up her unfavorable ratings at the very moment when she was trying to introduce herself to the country as a presidential candidate. And at the same time, Bannon, who at the time was the chairman of Breitbart News, had been going after the Republican House Speaker, John Boehner, and finally got him to resign. So he was someone who was gleefully going after the establishment in both parties and having a real effect.
So he was dangerous to Hillary Clinton in her presidential aspirations. He was dangerous to John Boehner in his role as Speaker of the House then. Do you still see him as dangerous in the White House, or is this a different kettle of fish?
Certainly could be. He is dangerous to many of our existing political norms, and we've seen Trump smash through those for 11 days straight now. So, yeah, I don't think there's ever been a figure like Bannon in the White House before. I mean, certainly presidents have had top political advisors, you know, a David Axelrod or a Karl Rove, but these are people who've spent a lifetime in electoral politics, and Bannon hasn't. I mean, he's been an ideologue and an activist, and now suddenly finds himself in the seat of power at the White House.
Josh Green, when we see Donald Trump rolling out policies, we see the White House rolling out executive orders, when we listen to Donald Trump, whether in the inaugural address or other times, if there's a Steve Bannon imprint on Trump, if there's a Steve Bannon spin on him, what is that?
It almost in every way, shape, and form, you can see the effect that Bannon has on Trump. My own analysis is that what Bannon did was to recognize a lot of Trump's impulses, and I think Trump recognized in Bannon that here was someone with an ideology who could weave together a lot of things I think and put them into a coherent political philosophy, a coherent political argument that would work in the context of a presidential race. If you look at Trump's many pretend runs for president in the past, there actually are themes running through, you know, the idea that the U.S. is losing at trade deals. He was talking about that back in 1987 when he first toyed with the idea of running for president. I think what Bannon was able to do was take that and knit it into an ideology, the idea that what Trump stands for is American nationalism, and pitch that in a way that had more resonance with ordinary voters than I think a lot of journalists, certainly myself, expected.
Josh Dawsey, we just heard Chuck Todd say that he's the main philosophical driver in the White House. If that's true, what's the philosophy, Josh?
I think the philosophy is a very populist nationalist philosophy. You know, I think he has very heavily driven the America First notion that the president has talked about at length. I also think he has driven some of the president's, more provocative moves and statements. Steve Bannon has enjoyed telling him to bash the media. He's enjoyed telling him that you can take on the Republican Party. I mean, there's kind of a provocateur in Donald Trump, but he also sees in Steve Bannon, who, is telling him you can embrace these things that Republicans have traditionally seen as a third rail and haven't touched. I mean, I think a perfect example was during the campaign after the, infamous Access Hollywood tape, and Donald Trump brought several of the Bill Clinton accusers to the debate. You saw Steve Bannon in the background grinning, and folks internally said that was a quintessential Steve Bannon move. So I think he is a very strong ideologue who also has a volcanic personality and embraces the part of Donald Trump who says, I wasn't beholden to anyone, I won anyway, by appealing to folks who were forgotten, you know, the quote unquote deplorables. And, you know, he is telling Donald Trump all the time, focus on your base, you know, focus on those issues. And, you know, I don't think Bannon is a conciliatory figure. I mean, he is basically telling Trump, you know, run this like you ran your campaign and go after the people who voted for you. And, you know, things will figure themselves out.
Everybody is really curious where that's going to go. Josh Green, we saw this Daily Beast report that's had a lot of attention in recent days, where Daily Beast reporter talking about Bannon talking with him. This was a ways back, and saying that Bannon said to him that he never calls himself a populist or even a nationalist. That he had said to this guy, "I'm a Leninist," and you know the Daily Beast guy asked him what he meant, and then he's quoted saying this. Steve Bannon's quoted saying, "Lenin wanted to destroy the state, and that's my goal too. I want to bring everything crashing down and destroy all of today's establishment." Josh Green, does that sound like a credible report of something Bannon would have said?
Yeah, absolutely, though. But I think what's been missed, I mean, this alarmist quote was kind of racing around Twitter again yesterday. I think what's missing here is some context.
Okay.
Bannon said that, I believe, in 2013.
Yep.
And at the time, Bannon's role was editor-in-chief of Breitbart News, and he was the establishment he was railing against was not necessarily the U.S. government. It was the Republican political establishment, people like House Speaker John Boehner, who Bannon and Breitbart helped drive out of office. So I'm not sure that the same ideas would apply now that Bannon is in the White House. I talked to him the day after the election. I actually brought up this quote. I said, "Look, you know, this is something you've said. Does this carry over into what you and Trump plan to do in the White House?" And he said, "No." And he gave me a quote, and I'll just read it. He said, "This is not the French Revolution. They destroyed the basic institutions of their society and changed their form of government. What Trump represents is a restoration of true American capitalism. The elites have taken all the upside for themselves, push the downside to the working and the middle-class Americans," and Bannon said he and Trump were going to change that. So different historical analogy, slightly less alarming, but obviously, as we can see from the first 11 days, this isn't something that's going to be done within the ordinary bounds of American politics.
Josh, elites have taken the upside for themselves. I mean, there is certainly evidence of that in just the sort of distribution of wealth and income in this country. Everybody knows about the income inequality, no question about it. It's the Breitbart News part that gets a lot of people's attention here, and the very sort of celebration of white nationalism there. And Steve Bannon was editor in chief; he was later publisher. What about that piece? How does that play into his view of the world, Josh? How much of that belongs hanging around his neck?
I think some of it does. Bannon insists that he is not a white nationalist; that he is an economic nationalist. And in the time I've spent with him over the last few years, you know, I'd never heard him say anything, you know, racist or supportive of white nationalists, but I do think a fair criticism you can make of Bannon and Breitbart is they're not bothered by having white nationalists as allies. Bannon actually brought this up a couple of years ago in an interview, not with me, and said, "Well, you know, all that racism stuff, that'll wash out in the end. What we need are these outsider, these populist people to kind of storm the establishment and take it over." That's kind of what's happened. You know, Bannon would argue this with what's going on here, I think, with the executive order, too, is that he is looking out for what's best for America. And in Bannon's worldview and in Trump's worldview, that entails shutting off immigration from these majority Muslim countries, maybe reducing immigration overall in order to tighten labor markets and get the wages of American workers that have been so stagnant over the last couple of decades to rise. That I think, is the theory behind what Bannon and Trump are trying to do.
I mean, the high-tech leaders are sort of freaking out in the last few days about feeling that maybe those pinchers, and how does that leading part of the economy stay healthy if you stop the income inflows of immigrants, who've been so important to entrepreneurship and more there. But on the other hand, we have seen what's happened with income in this country. And then comes the National Security Council. This really got people's attention over the weekend. The same time the big protests were going on the immigration front, the refugee front, you've got him put on the Principals Committee of the National Security Council, and people were just pulling their hair out. Here was Arizona Senator John McCain, Republican, of course, on Face the Nation, said he doesn't like one bit the idea of Steve Bannon on the National Security Council, or what appeared to be the demotion of the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, the director of National Intelligence. Here's McCain.
"I am worried about the National Security Council, who are the members of it and who are the permanent members. The appointment of Mr. Bannon is something which is a radical departure from any National Security Council in history.
Radical departure, one of a number. And of course, here was a former defense secretary under George Bush and then for a while under President Obama, Robert Gates, on ABC's This Week. Same theme, talking about President Trump's changes to the National Security Council.
My biggest concern is there are actually, under the law, only two statutory advisors to the National Security Council, and that's the Director of Central Intelligence, or the DNI, and the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. I think pushing them out of the National Security Council meetings, except when their specific issues are at stake, is a big mistake.
Okay, here's a break, Josh Dossi. I mean, Karl Rove, you can't get more central as an advisor to George W. Bush than Karl Rove, but he was not in these meetings. David Axelrod observed sometimes, but now we've got a seat for Steve Bannon. Why, Josh Dossi?
Well, I think it goes back to the fact that in Trump world, the president, you know, is slow to trust people, and he does embrace, you know, Bannon. He trusts Bannon. I think he takes Bannon's counsel more than he does others. You know, the White House has said, you know, Bannon was in the Navy. He has, you know, a military background. They think he has wisdom about geopolitics and the world order.
But he wasn't that high in the Navy. I mean, kind of a desk jockey, and no big deal, really.
Correct. I'm just saying that is one of their defenses.
I mean,
for
at
why
sea too, but
this.
Not in a high position there.
Right. But you know, so I think the point from the president is, you know, these are the folks who are giving me advice on the most sensitive of national security and intelligence issues. These are the folks who will decide, you know, whether we go to war, or whether we, you know, engage in a covert activity. You know, basically, you know, the most difficult decisions that you can make. And, you know, we've seen time and time again that the president, you know, trusts a kind of a key group of allies, and Bannon's one of those. And, you know, Bannon has the ear of him. He thinks his strategy is often right over pretty much anyone else but Jared Kushner. And I think the president is more comfortable with him in the room. You know, we've learned time and time again watching how the president interacts is that he often, you know, listens to the last person who's talked to him on any given issue. And he often, you know, does not get into the details of you know, intricate discussions. I mean, he's very public. He doesn't read books. I mean, he has said, I get my intelligence from, you know, the shows, from watching several hours of television, from kind of oral conversations with people. So having someone like Steve Bannon in there will kind of dissect, you know, what happens at a meeting to the president. And, you know, whether or not you agree with Mr. Bannon's opinion on things, and we really don't know exactly what it would be on national security, that could be either, you know, a good thing or a really bad thing.
Josh Green, you got John McCain saying radical departure from any National Security Council in history. Why now have a political guy in there? Karl Rove wasn't in there. Why? I mean, even in the heart of everything that went on with Iraq, why introduce that now? And what are the implications of that for the decisions being made in the right direction when the chips are really down?
Well, I think Josh's story yesterday really showed why now, because Trump trusts Bannon above anybody else and has no apparent concern for political norms that say you shouldn't have a political advisor in an NSC meeting. I think it's really as simple as that. I think the reason it's so worrisome to people like McCain is that most people would agree that politics shouldn't be a factor in the realm of U.S. national security. And having a political advisor, especially one as powerful as Steve Bannon, in that meeting could shift the focus to something other than national security. You don't want politics and thinking about politics and what's best for Trump domestically to influence national security decisions.
But is he, I mean, you know his background, you profiled him. Does he see himself as just a political advisor, or is he suddenly now our geostrategic, conductor here too? What does that mean if we're talking about...
You know, geostrategy didn't really come into play a lot, you know, a year and a half ago when I was spending time with Bannon, because nobody, even Bannon, could have imagined that he would wind up in the position he's in today.
But that's where the NSC is, and he's there all the time now.
Well, sure, but I mean, you know, back up 18 months,
yeah.
Steve Bannon is the chairman of Breitbart News, railing against Jeb Bush and the GOP establishment. I don't think he had any inkling that he could wind up as the chief political strategist for President Donald Trump. None of us could.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. And we're talking this hour about Steve Bannon and what's going on in Washington, the president's top strategy guy in the innermost, inner circle, and how he sees the world as he whispers in the ear, more than whispers in the ear, of President Donald Trump. Josh Green is with us, senior national correspondent for Bloomberg Businessweek. His profile last year, that this man is the most dangerous political operative in America. That's long before he was in the Oval Office. Josh Dossi is with us, White House reporter for Politico. His piece yesterday, the man behind Trump, still Steve Bannon. I guess that's pretty apparent. You can join us this hour. How do you read Steve Bannon? Is he disruptive in a good way? Is he disturbing in a dark way? Where do his instincts, his worldview, take the country? Tape of Steve Bannon is rare. He's just not out there in front of a microphone very often. But in 2014, he gave a talk at the Vatican. It was via Skype. It's gotten a lot of attention. He spoke in favor of strong nationalist movements in nations around the world. The speech was recorded by somebody on their computer. It's pretty crummy sound quality. But listen closely. Here's Steve Bannon.
I happen to think individual sovereignty for countries is a good thing and a strong thing. I think strong countries and strong nationalist movements in countries make strong neighbors. And that is really the building blocks that built Western Europe and the United States, and I think it's what can see us forward.
Strong nationalist movements in countries make strong neighbors. I think that's what can see us forward. Steve Bannon there via Skype to the Vatican, and a little more from that, talking with that Vatican NGO in Rome, spoke about an unfolding crisis in what he called the Judeo-Christian West.
I believe that we've come horribly off track in the years since the fall of the Soviet Union, and we're starting now in the 21st century, which I believe strongly is a crisis both of our church, a crisis of our faith, a crisis of the West, and a crisis of capitalism.
Steve Bannon to the Vatican. Now he's in the White House. Josh Dossi, Josh Green, stand by. Callers here. Dolores in Waterford, Pennsylvania. Dolores, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom, and hi to your guests.
Yeah.
I think this guy is totally unhinged, and I think he serves as a great danger to this country. I don't think he has much use. Obviously, he doesn't have much use for the media. As he said the other day, they need to shut up, which to me now you're attacking the First Amendment. So my question is this. This smacks of an authoritarian government when you're going to control what the truth is and what, you know, comes out of that White House. That's really disturbing. Conversation regarding Lenin took place at a book party in his Capitol Hill townhouse back in November 2013.
Yep.
Because I did see that, and I was wondering how true that was. But I have one more point to make. I find it deeply disturbing that someone who spent 7 years in the Navy years ago, okay, has now a more prominent position on the National Security Council than someone like General Dumford, who is chairman of the JCS, and who has all this military experience over 30 years plus.
Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. Dolores, we've got it, and we've got it all. I don't know. Josh Dossi, respond. Dolores says unhinged. Well, unhinged like a fox, and she says smacks authoritarian. How do you respond to both of those?
I will say what Dolores just said is something that I've heard from thousands of folks on Twitter and emails and lots of, concern across the board. I mean, I think among the president's sharpest critics, and he kind of enters office as kind of a historically unpopular figure for a president. Bannon is the thing that they fear the most. I mean, you saw the other night there was a Stop President Bannon Twitter
hashtag trending
That went trending. This guy has become a really powerful figure internally, but he's also become, I think, symbolic of a symbol of something else. Outside of the White House. And I think when it comes to, Bannon, one of the things that we have to be careful of is knowing, what exactly he is advising the president and what folks may just be blaming him for behind the scenes.
Yeah, but we can see things now. I mean, unless you think he's not to do with the steps that Donald Trump is taking. It's not as if
anything. I think a lot of his steps so far we have, but I'm just saying he's become such a character from the New York Times interview he did last week where he said the media should shut up. I mean, today the Times had an editorial that said stop President Bannon. I mean, you're seeing so much media coverage of this guy, and you also wonder if it will upset the president Trump if he becomes, you know, the star. I mean, one thing we've heard repeatedly from aides and advisors and people who know the president is he doesn't like folks who get more media attention than himself.
Yeah.
He doesn't, you know, appreciate that. So we'll see how this happens.
We're trying to cut through the symbolism and get to the meat right here. Matt in Miami, Florida. Matt, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I think one thing that I took from reading the transcript of that Vatican meeting and some of Bannon's other writing is he views Islam as engaged in a long-term bloody conflict with the West. And I think him being present in the National Security Council brings that kind of theocratic ideology to the executive branch that is potentially really dangerous, especially going alongside his, you know, nationalistic tendencies as it is.
Matt,
I'm wondering what you guys think.
Yeah, we'll pick it up. Josh Green, how about it? Theocratic.
Yeah, I think it's a very smart point, and I think it's true. If you listen to Bannon talk, if you read Breitbart's coverage, clearly they're promoting the idea that the U.S. is at war with radical Islam. Now, that's a
religious war.
A belief, I think, that extends beyond just Trump and Bannon. I mean, that is almost a mainstream Republican position today.
But is it in the security circles? I mean, we heard this NPR report this morning saying, you know, they quoted a dozen different people that they had polled who with lots of experience in national security saying that is the wrong way to frame it. That's a losing way to frame it.
You go up to Capitol Hill and talk to your average rank and file Republican congressman.
Yeah.
They will tell you that the U.S. is at war with radical Islam.
They're politicians.
I think between politicians and national security folks. But I want to make a point in regard to the caller's question, which is that, you know, I think he's right. American nationalism, as Bannon and Trump views it, is not just an economic philosophy or an economic strategy, but a religious one, too. In talking to people close to Bannon about the refugee executive order, I said, you know, I emailed, said, you know, why is he doing this? Like, why prevent green card holders from coming back into the U.S.? Permanent legal residents who have been vetted by the government. And his friend replied, America first, Americans first. This is about national security, not just economics. So I think we're only just now coming to fully appreciate the scope of the ideas that Bannon and Trump have in store for the country. And like the caller said, I think that there really is something alarming about this in the fact that these ideas will have representation in National Security Council meetings.
Representation, to say the least. I mean, you can say America first, but that doesn't make America safer just because you say America first. But there's Steve Bannon with the ear of the president and the president elected to the office. Robert in Tampa, Florida. Robert, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Tom.
What do you think, Robert?
I don't think Bannon's views are radical. I just think they've generally been ignored by the left, and now you're seeing the backlash. Oriana Fallaci, the Italian late Italian journalist, has been speaking for almost two decades now about the dangers of allowing Islamic culture to creep into the West, and the reason is not against religion. It's that the West is based on a Judeo-Christian, Greco-Roman mindset, and the Islamic world is from a completely different mindset that does not accept broad-based human human rights, women's rights, minority rights.
You know, I know a lot of Muslims who would argue with that, Robert, but what about this country? This country is based on freedom of religion, so how do you square that circle, Robert?
Well, there's a paradox there, because at some point, if you don't protect the culture in which you live from cultural incursion from outside, you may lose it. So there is a problem there. And Europe is seeing that, where you would have people speaking against democracy and against European values, and are protected by the very laws that they oppose.
Robert, when you say that, I hear you. But does that make you a white nationalist, or how do you think about that?
Well, I'm white, and I do believe that countries are stronger when they have a strong cultural identity, and it's not diluted to the point where it becomes non-existent. But I'm not a white nationalist in the sense of some person living in an enclave in the Northwest, you know?
A survivalist. Robert, I got it. I appreciate your call. Josh Green, not a radical. Steve Bannon, not a radical. What do you say?
Oh, I think he's very much a radical, and he would say so proudly. And I think that's one reason why Trump's first 2 weeks have been so radically at odds with anything we've seen from any president before, from issuing these executive orders to firing the acting attorney general blowing up diplomatic protocols with countries like China and the UK. He's absolutely a radical, and what's happening in the country right now, I think, is inarguably radical. So that's certainly a reflection of Bannon. I do think, I think Josh Dawson might have made this point earlier, that I do think it's important to kind of take a deep breath and not over attribute Bannon's influence in the Trump world. Trump does what Trump wants. He clearly values Bannon's counsel and listens to him up to a point. But even in discussions with Bannon during the campaign, everybody around Trump often was very frustrated that Trump wouldn't take their counsel, that he went off on his own and sort of attacked people left and right.
But are you saying there, Josh, that means
like crowd sizes?
Yeah, but does that mean Trump's the radical or Bannon's the radical?
Well, I think they both are, but I think Trump is a radical too. I mean, this is not a situation. I think there's a danger in people coming away with the idea that Steve Bannon has Donald Trump on marionette strings. That's just not the fact. I think a lot of the alarm about Bannon has led people to believe that.
I got a caller on that front, maybe. One second, Justin, I will bring it to you. But David in Peterborough, New Hampshire. David, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I beg to differ a little bit. I don't think Trump has a lot had a lot other than a couple of narrow ideas of what was important to him. What's mostly important to Trump is being angry at people who prick his narcissism. And I think that Bannon is really Iago the manipulator to Trump's Othello.
What's your background, David? Why should we listen to what you think about it?
Well, I was in the intelligence community, and I spent a lot of time studying world leaders. And what we're seeing is Trump had a few ideas, right? And he knew what resonated with the base, which I always think of as a double entendre. The base can be quite base, and that's where Trump goes. But Trump, you see the quality of his tweets, what he reacts to, and he's angry. And he's angry at anyone who dares not support him or dares miscount an election or dares miscount who showed up for a speech. And I think that what Bannon is effectively doing is saying, I can make Trump exact revenge on his enemies with the most in-your-face, try-this-on-for-size decisions. And I think that's what Bannon seems to be very skillful at eliciting for Trump, because Trump didn't have any of these ideas. These are not his ideas. He had a few ideas. He had ideas about a wall. He had ideas about security. He had some ideas about jobs. But a lot of the stuff that's coming out, I think, is Bannon saying, well, you really want to get him? And by the way, Tom, just wait till tonight at 8 o'clock when we see who the Supreme Court nominates.
Yeah, news is coming. David, I really appreciate your call. Appreciate your call from Peterborough. Josh Dawson, respond to that interpretation. Iago, the manipulator. I mean, Josh Green says not a marionette on a string. Our caller sort of begs to differ. How do you see it?
I don't think it's quite a marionette on the string. I would agree with Josh. I do think you have a president who on the campaign trail, you know, had very fluid positions. He would sometimes change his positions, you know, on a number of different important issues. We didn't really know how he felt on the campaign trail. And we've seen, you know, his cabinet nominees lay out positions sometimes that are at odds with him. So this was not, you know, a president who ran on kind of an ideology of, you know, straight Republican, straight Democrat. I mean, it was kind of a zigzagging all over the sphere on various issues based on sometimes nothing more than his mood or his cult of personality. I think the other thing to add is that when we've seen in these executive orders, you know, you have cabinet secretaries, top officials at agencies, even some senior White House staff who said, you know, we were not consulted on this order. We didn't know exactly what to do, what would happen. And you have a very small inner circle that, you know, kind of keeps information to themselves to, you know, amass power. So I do think you have a culmination of factors that gives Bannon a lot of influence. One is that on many issues, Trump really doesn't care about the granular details. It's more about being perceived as strong and being perceived as, you know, this populist figure that his supporters like. And two, you know, there's not a whole large number of people who are influencing the president. You have a very tight inner circle you know, that's writing these orders and is talking about them. You're not having, you know, communication staff with a rollout plan. You're not having, you know, lots of liaison on the Hill and getting allies on board. I mean, this is a very small operation, just like the campaign was. So when you have a president who, you know, doesn't really care about a lot of issues in the granular and a small staff, I think those people have the potential to have, you know, significant sway and significant power.
We certainly see the fingerprints of somebody with a sense for drama here. Of course, Donald Trump has that too. So drama squared, maybe. Josh Green, in that, think about Steve Bannon. Does he care about, as people watch Donald Trump, you know, sort of pushing forward rapidly on a lot of fronts, does Bannon care about separation of powers, checks and balances? Where does he go on the issue of strongman rule?
No, I don't think he does particularly, and I think part of the reason I think Trump has run into problems with some of these executive orders is both the fact that he and Bannon don't really seem to care much at all, coupled with the fact that neither one of them has any experience in government whatsoever. So you wind up with a situation where these executive orders aren't vetted, where allies on the Hill don't have a heads up and know what's coming, and so what results is chaos. But on the other hand, chaos has always been something that Bannon has sought to create. He thinks he operates best in a chaotic environment. We know from the campaign that Trump believes he operates best in a chaotic environment. But in speaking to Bannon, you know, after the election, the phrase he kept using was paradigm shift. Like, we need a paradigm shift. We're going to change the way that people think about American politics. We're going to come right out of the gate. We're going to do big things from the get-go. And as it turns out, that's exactly what he's done.
You guys are great. You've got us wide awake here, and I'm grateful to each of you for being with us. Joshua Green, senior national correspondent for Bloomberg Businessweek. Josh, thank you very much for joining us today.
You bet.
And Josh Dossie, White House reporter for Politico. Terrific to have you with us. Josh Dossie, thank you very much. Keep up the good work.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Thanks for being with us today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.